From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This was the week of the YouTube debate, where questions came from lesbian couples and snowmen, breast cancer survivors and gun owners, mothers of soldiers and ministers. 39 citizen questions in all. The questions were provocative, often pointed, and most were questions a journalist would unnormally ask. So how much of a turning point did the YouTube event represent? And what about the overall impact of the internet on American politics? In the hour ahead, we'll explore what's going on online and how that might impact voters and politicians in the year ahead. I'm Dave Iverson. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. We all know the internet is changing American politics. We've known that at least since the Dean campaign of 2004, despite how that campaign eventually turned out. And this year we've seen the internet's impact on fundraising, on strategy, and of course on this week's debate, the YouTube-CNN debate, which featured citizen questions submitted on videotape. The YouTube debate was widely praised for the questions that were asked, if not always for the answers that were given. There was something powerful about seeing a woman with breast cancer pull off her wig and pose a question, or a group of relief workers in Darfur surrounded by the children that were there trying to assist. The power of the internet to engage citizens in a different way, from asking questions to taking political action, is what we want to talk about in the hour ahead. Does the access that the internet provides really democratize American politics? Will it alter the top-down structure of most campaigns? How will it impact the press? After all, those were pretty good questions that the YouTubers posed. And what about who's participating online? Are all voices really engaged? And then perhaps most important, will online participation impact voter participation on Election Day? Joining us now to take up those subjects, David Weinberger. He joins us from the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard University. He recently authored Everything is Miscellaneous, The Power of the New Digital Order. He advised the Howard Dean campaign in 2004, and this year is a volunteer advisor to the Edwards campaign. David Weinberger, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Bluey is here as well. He's the director of the Center for Media and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation. And you can find his blog at robertbluey.com. He also contributes to redstate.com. Robert Bluey, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you with us, as is Josh Harkinson. He is a reporter for Mother Jones magazine. He was a major contributor to their July-August cover story in Mother Jones, which was called Politics 2.0. Josh, good morning.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Happy to have all of you here. Let's start out with just a little bit of information and commentary on the YouTube debate in terms of whether or not it represented a real change, where it might be pointing us in terms of the kinds of interactions that citizens can now have with politicians. Because in a sense, Josh Harkinson first, it's not necessarily the newest thing in the world to involve citizens in debate. We can think back, for example, to the 1992 town hall debate with the first President Bush and Bill Clinton and Ross Perot, the one where the first President Bush famously looked at his watch partway through the debate. So citizens have been involved in debates for some time. What to you, if anything, was significant about the way that that evolved this week with YouTube?
Right. I think it's interesting to think about this almost as what's the difference between having the candidates on forum and having callers call in and ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
The only real difference is that there's video involved. And I suppose, it was exciting to see. It was fun to watch.
That's not a small thing in and of itself, if politics itself becomes more interesting.
Right, right. And, video does bring something added. When you have, two gay women together on a video screen asking, what do you think about us getting married? It's very visceral. And, you can't really get that, through radio necessarily in the same way or, through a newscaster asking the question.
Robert Bluey, from your perspective, and we should also note, of course, that the Republicans will have their turn with YouTubers coming up in a month or so. But what was your reaction to it? How would you change it, if you could, in terms of increasing citizen engagement that much further?
Well, as we know, there were 3,000 questions submitted for this debate, and just about 40 were picked and actually shown and are available on the YouTube website. So obviously, getting more of those questions out there before the public, getting candidates to answer them, I think would just, you know, obviously be beneficial to everybody involved and all the players involved. The one thing I would say is that CNN's producers selected all of the questions. So perhaps, you know, a way to change it for the Republican debate is to get some more citizen involvement in actually determining which questions are asked.
So citizens as editors, in effect?
In effect, absolutely. I think that would be would be very beneficial. I think Anderson Cooper, in fact, made the point that the most popular question that was submitted didn't get asked. I'd like to know why.
David Weinberger, how do you see the week that was with the YouTube debate, and what tweaks would you make in it to make it that much more true, I guess, to the spirit of citizen engagement?
Well, I think you're right to think of it as an evolutionary step. The world didn't change because of this, but I think it was actually an important evolutionary step. In addition to what's been said so far, which I agree with, the politics has been characterized by a type of alienation that comes about because politics gets played out on through the mainstream media, and mainstream media is a very expensive medium, and so only a handful of people can engage in it. So I think one of the exciting things about what happened was that here was really low quality in terms of production values, the low quality videos that were being shown. And we're okay with that. And the fact that we're okay with, I think what ultimately this is part of the trend away from being in love with the high production values to seeing them as, you know, this is not what we need in politics. This is the infusion, this has been the infusion of showbiz into politics. And this step this week started to express some more of the hostility towards the professionalism and showbiz qualities of politics.
The other part of that, along with the production value question, is that obviously traditionally television has been a one-way medium. It's been a way for politicians and their campaigns to deliver a message. And the promise of the internet, of course, has always been that it is more democratic, that there is more of an opportunity for there to be more of a two-way conversation. Is that really beginning to happen, David Weinberger? Are we really seeing that now politicians will listen to what's posted on the internet as much as just delivering a message back to an audience?
Absolutely, and it's misleading to look at the debate, this past debate, as an example of that because it was on TV. And so long as it's on TV, which is a broadcast medium, it's non-interactive, the only type of interactivity possible is to pick a handful of videos. Hopefully we'll pick them more democratically next time. But it's still TV, so that environment is a very tough one to see the real change. And the real change will be, for example, in terms of debates, will be as candidates go out onto YouTube and start the process of continuous interaction. And it, by the way, cannot just be the candidates because they don't have enough time. The real democratization, I think, that's been going on since at least the Dean campaign is campaigns, many of them, getting more comfortable with the idea that they are not the center of the broadcast universe, so to speak, and that their supporters are desperately eager to talk not just with the candidate but with one another as well. The democratization is happening in the lateral connections, not simply the connections up and down in the campaign.
I'm curious about this idea of also extending the conversation, Robert Bluey. The question from the YouTube debate that sort of played out the most this week was the question that was posed to Barack Obama first on whether or not he would go and meet with leaders that have not been met with before, whether that's Castro in Cuba or the leaders of North Korea and so forth. And we've seen that sort of continue to bubble and percolate over the course of the week. Is that an example of continuing the conversation?
I think that certainly is. I think that, for instance, you probably wouldn't have heard Anderson Cooper ask that question of any of the candidates, and the fact that the idea came from a citizen who was interested in that, and look at what it's turned into now, a major debate that could be groundbreaking in terms of who goes ahead of whom in this Democratic primary now. Hillary Clinton's trying to capitalize. Barack Obama's trying to capitalize. They're really not engaging citizens on YouTube, after the fact, but it's certainly playing out in the mainstream media. So for CNN, it's very beneficial because they can point to this as an example of the success of the debate, for instance.
The point Robert makes, Josh, on citizens ask different kinds of questions, and that's been a hallmark of citizen-based debates all along, that they ask questions going back to that debate in 1992. The most famous question that was asked of the first President Bush was for him to respond to a young woman who posed the question, can you talk about someone you know who's been affected by the sort of tough economic times? And the first President Bush couldn't really answer that question. So citizens do ask different questions. Is that part of what's significant about this, that it may displace to a degree the kinds of questions that are asked because they are different than what traditional journalists ask?
Yeah, I think it could well be that we'll see more of that. You know, it is interesting. I mean, again, you know, as others have pointed out, it's kind of hard to say that the YouTube debate, CNN YouTube debate, is a good example of that, because those questions, though submitted by individuals, were picked by the editors at CNN. So if everyone were to vote on the questions, it's hard to say whether some of those really quirky questions that mm-hmm. we might view as being emblematic of the YouTube era would actually make it through, you know, on a pure popularity contest. But, you know, those are the kinds of questions that regular people ask. And, you know, those are the kinds of questions that regular people debate amongst themselves. And so, you know, all of these different ideas and questions will get much more of an airing than they have in the past.
Josh Harkinson is a reporter for Mother Jones magazine. Their current cover story is focused on this topic. It's called Politics 2.0. He joins us along with Robert Bluey of the Heritage Foundation, and of his blog, by the way, is called robertbluey.com if you're interested in his writings. And David Weinberger joins us as well from the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard University. David, what about the nature of campaigns changing? Will they become more democratic? They're usually pretty top-down structures, right? So how is the internet really changing the way in which campaigns are run?
Yeah, I think absolutely it is. It's happening. We're already seeing it. You can see, in some ways, it's a vanishing act because we get used to the change and it doesn't seem like a change. But if you think back to, because this is a change in norms and that's how norms work. So if you think back to the previous national election, it was considered quirky and odd for the Dean campaign to have a blogger. But the blog, and for good reason, because campaigns usually are so top-down that only two people get to speak for the campaign, the candidate and the press officer, and both of those are taught to stay on message, whereas the Dean campaign introduces Blogger, who's a 31-year-old supporter, who was off message. Because blogs on message are just boring. Nobody reads them. The whole point about a blog is to be off message. So here, 3 years ago, was an idea that seemed quirky and eccentric, and now campaigns take it for granted generally that they're going to have a blog, and this is going to be the main way that they're going to talk to their supporters on the web. Very briefly, the other thing that is still is happening, whether campaigns want it to or not, whether they're doing it or not, is that the supporters are finding one another and organizing themselves. Not just organizing, they're talking.
Yeah. And how does that help a campaign? I mean, if it becomes that much more participatory and in a sense that much more chaotic, David Weinberg, how does that help a campaign?
Well, it's not simply chaotic. I mean, the lesson of the web is that the world's largest, most complex assemblage of human creativity ever in our history has no managers, and it's not chaotic. Order emerges. So you get a couple things. You get this emergent order. You get ideas that otherwise wouldn't have surfaced, but the main thing that you get is supporters who are fully engaged. They're not your foot soldiers. They are engaged in your campaign and in democracy.
Robert Bluey, how does this playing out on the conservative side? I mean, there isn't really an equivalent to Move On. There have been a couple of attempts at that, something new called the Vanguard. But it doesn't seem to be gelling on the conservative side as well. And I'm curious about that. I mean, in some ways, is that because Democrats have always been a little more chaotic in a sense, and some of those attributes play out well, as David Weinberger is suggesting, on the web, and may not be as come by as naturally on the conservative side? Is that fair?
Well, I think that's part of the problem. I think that another issue is that the Democrats have somebody to rally against, and that's President Bush. And another thing to rally against is the Iraq War, and you have people very unified against those two things, and it's brought them together for a similar cause and to make a change about that. And so we've had 6 years of Republican leadership, and Obviously, in the last election, Republicans are no longer controlling Congress because Democrats were able to organize online, and a lot of stories bubbled up into the mainstream press and caused a lot of headaches for Republican candidates. So I think we're going to see the same thing in the presidential race. We're already seeing it. Now, I mean, it's just amazing to me that Republicans are now talking about not participating in the YouTube debate on September 17th. You've only had two people commit, Ron Paul and John McCain. Others are criticizing the format, and I think it would be a tremendous mistake for the candidates not to engage this in this Democratic forum.
How do you see that, Josh Harkinson, as you worked on putting together your story about the way in which people respond to this with comfort levels versus high anxiety?
You mean Republicans in general or—
Well, just I'm curious about whether or not the internet age benefits certain kinds of candidates, be they on the left or the right, more than others, and what the consequence, I guess, of that may be.
Right. Well, you know, I think the general wisdom is that the internet is a media that can be embraced much more readily by the dark horse campaigns because it is inherently risky. You know, we are at this kind of turning point in the way campaigns work, and people are still feeling out what the rules are, what the rules of engagement are online. And so it's very easy to make a gaffe. You know, we've seen the Macaca video, you know, George Allen's meltdown with his racist comment that spread virally through YouTube. And, you know, we're going to see a lot more of that in the future as, you know, people are caught in these unguarded moments by, you know, regular citizens taping them up with their cell phones, you know. And so, you know, there are risks involved for candidates that embrace that world fully, you know, by outsourcing their campaign functions to regular citizens. I mean, we saw that with the Obama campaign with his MySpace page, which he which was created by a regular guy named Joe Anthony, who later had a spat with the Obama campaign over whether he should be paid for his services. And this led to the shutdown of his MySpace page. He had, you know, hundreds of thousands of friends, and suddenly he had a handful of friends. And he was drubbed in the blogosphere for basically, you know, not treating the Netroots right. So there are risks, but there are also huge advantages in the way that you can raise money and mobilize supporters. And so, you know, the second and third runner campaigns are much more likely to embrace those.
Do you see, David Weinberger, whether how this – can you have a sense yet, I guess, for how this will actually translate into support come Election Day? Obviously, the Howard Dean campaign in the end wasn't able to do that. I'm curious about how you see that this time around. There's been the most activity perhaps with the Obama campaign. That's certainly how they've raised a lot of money. But is there a big jump between energy and excitement and involvement online and actually turning up to vote?
Well, I think the inflection point is the moment that somebody gets the nomination, because that's the point at which the risk of the internet suddenly does not seem worth taking. And so front runners as well, as John says, they will they get counseled. They're told your job is not to make a mistake. And that may well happen in this next election. But I think over time that's going to have to break. It cannot be maintained precisely because everything that a candidate does is going to be publicly available. It's all going to be YouTubed. Every moment of weakness, every possible statement that can be taken out of context, just as, and so I think it's an absolutely similar situation. Kids, young people who are saying things on MySpace that they don't want their employers to see in 10 years because they're not thinking about that, the employers also are going to have to learn, as we as the citizens are going to have to learn, that imperfection is part of being human. We're going to have to get more forgiving about this. The gotcha politics there's just too many opportunities for it on the internet, and so we're not going to be able to maintain the safety of running in a tightly controlled way forever.
Which must just freak out candidates, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is terrifying to them, but too bad. This is the world. And in this world, I mean, it's one of the reasons why the Republicans are not signing up for the YouTube debate. Dignity starts to look like artifice.
We want to add another voice to our conversation at this point because we've talked some already about engagement and the kinds of opportunities for democratizing politics by allowing people to participate in new ways. But there's also some question about who those voices are and whether or not the internet really is reflecting all voices in a fair and complete way. Joining us now, Chris Rabb. He's founder and what he likes to call the chief evangelist for something called Afro Netizen. You can also view his blog. blogging work at bloggingwhileblack.net. That's bloggingwhileblack.net. Chris Ramp, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. It's actually bloggingwhileblack.com.
Sorry. My apologies. Well, we'll correct that and say that several times over the course of the next 35 minutes. Give us your perspective, though, on who, to what extent do you think are people missing in this debate? We've talked some already on this program about who's engaged, but who's not.
Well, obviously, people who don't have access to the Internet, who do not have computers in their homes, for people who rely on dial-up, and people who may have the access but don't have the social capital and context for really knowing how best to leverage the web. And that's, I think that's one of the biggest disparities when you're talking about various demographics of communities who are online but who use the web differently, and as a result, and consequently are underrepresented in a lot of conversations and opportunities.
And how could that begin to change? And are there any campaigns right now that are particularly interested in doing that and trying to cross that digital divide and making more of an outreach to those communities that you describe?
Well, if you're talking about campaigns, capital C, in terms of the electoral process and electoral politics, I would say no, simply because the electorate is such a small percentage of the American people. We, very few of us who are registered to vote actually come out and vote consistently. Those of us who do are called super voters, and that's a very small swath of adult age Americans. You have folks who have criminal records, who are felons in many states who are not able to vote. You have young people, Black people who have largely been written off by both parties simply because they're not considered low-hanging fruit. And certainly for the Democratic Party, which I understand a lot better than the Republican Party, or at least are far more involved with, it's easier for them to commit to getting fickle white suburbanites and NASCAR dads than it is to reach out to a potential voting population that when we do vote, 9 out of 10 of us vote Democrat every time. But because they choose not to invest in our communities and empower our communities, a much smaller group of people are being reached.
Chris Rabb joins us. He's founder of Afro-Netizen, and his blog is called bloggingwhileblack.com. That's bloggingwhileblack.com. Are campaigns tuned into this, Josh Harkinson, as you put together your article, or is there an awareness that everyone's excited about the web, but it's really a glass that's not completely full?
I think they are. And, I mean, you have to realize that, I mean, the web is still not the dominant strategy or predominant place that campaigns are taking action right now. I mean, they are putting an increasingly large share of their resources there, but it's still not the majority. I think the campaigns don't really have to worry so much about, whether or not they're reaching everyone through the web. But I do think that bloggers need to think about that and talk about that, and groups like MoveOn.org need to talk about it.
We'll come back and talk more about the impact that the Internet is having on politics in America and what might be done to broaden that impact more fully. You can join our conversation now by calling us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. forum@kqed.org. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, online America and how that's changing politics, or if it's changing politics. How did the YouTube debate this week have an impact on our political process? And beyond that, how is the Internet really beginning to shape the American political picture? We welcome your participation in our conversation. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. John writes, at least the Democrats who are willing to participate in the YouTube debate, which allows citizens a chance to directly ask questions. Too often these days, politicians, like President Bush, do everything they can to control their audience, control the media, and only appear on favorable shows, such as Fox or Rush Limbaugh. Will Republicans have the courage to participate in a YouTube debate? Robert Bluey, what do you think?
I think they ultimately will. Just in the time that we've been on the show, there's a new petition up, SaveTheDebate.com, which is put together by a few people on the right to encourage the Republican candidates who haven't committed to participating in the debate to signing up immediately. And I think that it's just it's one of those things where you have a tremendous opportunity to reach a new audience, a younger audience probably, that would be participating through submitting videos on YouTube and watching CNN. I don't see why they would pass on this opportunity.
Mike in San Francisco, because politicians typically do not answer the question posed, it's hard to get real questions answered. How would you suggest having politicians answer the question posed? David Weinberger, perhaps you can take that up. One of the old dilemmas of citizen-based debates is that citizens frequently do ask really good questions, whether they're live in a town hall or on tape. The problem sometimes comes in the follow-up, that they're not necessarily as skilled at that, or, of course, in the case of the YouTube debate, really did not have that opportunity. So how do you bring together the good questions that citizens can pose and really trying to get politicians to answer those questions? I'm curious about your views about how citizenry and journalism can do a better job of that.
It's really hard to do on TV. The format of the last week's debate was typical, but it was ridiculous. It was not designed to enable us to find out what candidates believe. It was a question, then Anderson Cooper picks a couple people to ask, and that's it. It's a debased form of conversation. I don't know that we're going to do a lot better on TV. Maybe we can. I think the real change is going to be moving this stuff off of that medium, off of the broadcast media, which means continual engagement and conversation. And furthermore, it's not going to be possible to do this simply with the candidate. And this is going to change our notion of leadership. The candidate's just one person. And even if he or she devotes him or herself full time to engaging with the citizenry, which simply can't happen because they have to go raise money, for example, there still isn't enough time. So the solution, I believe, is to have your engaged supporters out engaged in the conversation as well. This has to be distributed all the way across the board. It has to be taken. TV is fine, but it cannot be the only or the real or the peak medium for doing this.
So something like having the foreign policy advisors to various candidates have some sort of online chat situation. Is that sort of what you're imagining, David?
I think that's one very good approach. And there are so many different, we are constantly inventing now new ways to talk together online, to do it intermittently and to do it continuously, that, this is a place where we need yet more ingenuity.
And to some of our callers who join our conversation this morning, let's start in San Jose. Robert, you're on.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is Robert from San Jose. And my call today is on how the Internet enabled factions to gain more power over, I guess, public discourse.
Factions meaning, yeah? Go ahead, Robert.
I was reading, I think it was one of Madison's Federalist Papers, I believe Federalist number 10, where he touts the expanse of the United States as being a great check against the power of factions and the ability of the majority to somehow oppress the minority. And so with the Internet having, you know, really decreased the overall size of the United States and the ability to share ideas, I'm curious if any of your guests have thought about that or addressed that question before.
All right. Let's see if we can get a response, Robert. Interesting question. I'm impressed that you're spending your time reading the Federalist Papers. Robert Bluey, you have a thought on that?
Well, I think that it raises an interesting point. Certainly, the Internet is flattening the world, as Thomas Friedman wrote, in The World is Flat, and it's having a tremendous impact in terms of bringing people together. And I guess, as Robert said on the phone, Making the United States a lot smaller. So I don't know. I think it's also bringing people together, though. I know that I've worked with people on the left that I probably wouldn't have worked with on an issue if it weren't for the internet. I can think of one thing that one coalition was the Open House Project, where there were a group of conservatives and a group of liberal bloggers who wanted to come together and create a more open Congress that provided new information online.
Well, that's an interesting observation, because frequently the criticism is made that people these days tend to just go to the source that reinforces their point of view, whether that's a television channel or online, and you have this sort of echo chamber effect, David Weinberger, and that you don't really kind of broaden or flatten things out, because all you really do is get reinforced with what you already think, whether you visit redstate.com or the Daily Coast or whatever it happens to be. Is that changing? Are we seeing more interchange, as Robert is suggesting, between the left and right online?
The echo chamber idea is a really tricky one. And I think the right question to ask is the one that, well, Yochai Benkler asks in his book, Wealth of Networks, which is not, how do you, so it's just too hard to figure. How do you figure how much like-minded reading and talking we do in the real world before the web, and how much we did, how much we do afterwards? So the question is perhaps does involvement in the web introduce you to more points of view than you would get by watching TV and reading newspaper? So even if you're a devoted Red State follower, you're still very likely, that's not the only site you go to on the web. You go there because talking with people with whom you agree is enjoyable and helpful. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But you also go elsewhere, and you also have stuff pushed at you. So it seems to me, although I don't know how to support this, but it seems to me intuitively clear that the web is broadening. It's bringing us into a far wider range of opinion than we ever got shoved through our mail slot in the newspaper.
I was looking at a conservative website yesterday. Robert, maybe you can help me with the name because I'm forgetting it now. But I thought they had something quite nice at the top of their webpage. They had friendlies where you could link to various conservative points of views, and then another section called the opposition, where you could link to the left. And if you went to that link, it said, we don't really agree with these people, but these are really smart people, and you really ought to be aware of what they're having to say. So you can, in fact, if you approach it that way, use the web to get lots of diversity. Robert, thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's – I'm not sure which website you're talking about specifically, but I know that James Joyner of Outside the Beltway often
talks –
That's the one. He often talks about that and does a pretty good job in terms of, I think, linking and having a discussion with the left and trying to, you know, bring in at least on the topics that they share agreement on, their viewpoints. I just would point out one other thing. On a website called openleft.com this week, Senator Dick Durbin has been soliciting feedback for a national broadband bill that he wants to write, and he wants to get feedback from the commenters on this blog. Well, I was critical of him for just having a conversation with liberals, and I was very encouraged to hear that his office is actually going to be reaching out and posting on Red State next week. And a non-ideological website, just for people who may not read either liberal or conservative blogs, and trying to get opinion from all over the place. So I think it is a positive development when some things like that happen.
And to Margaret next, who joins us in Berkeley. Margaret?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in two things. One, and this raises actually a larger question about women and technology generally, but do your guests have any insight into to the degree to which women are participating in online debates, online actions such as you've been describing? And secondly, whether there are any data relating to age breakdown in terms of accessibility. And I'd like to compliment the gentleman on the name of his website, Blogging While Black. I think it's brilliant. Thank you for taking my call.
Margaret, thank you. Chris, why don't you pick up on that, since that's your website, bloggingwhileblack.com. And if you can, comment on her question about who's participating, both in terms, she mentioned the question of gender and age, but race as well.
Sure. Well, I think one of the great places to go to get up-to-date information, certainly not the only one, is pewinternet.org. That's P-E-W, internet.org. And they really document online life and trends in America. But with regard to the comment, women are actively involved, as are communities of color, on every level.
The problem is that there's a disparity in terms of visibility and access to resources and social capital, such that what I've seen and many of my colleagues, particularly those who are self-identified progressives, see a mirroring of offline society where the people with the same demographics that benefit in society before the Internet are the same folks who are kind of leading the cause and are the poster people for the Internet and blogging and such. And that's a real problem for anyone who really believes in meaningful inclusiveness and leveling the playing field. And oftentimes I find myself at, in quotes, progressive conferences that focus or pay homage to new media where the audiences and the registrants are virtually all white and where all the panels are only men. And so you have a real problem. Now, if that's okay on the conservative side, perhaps, where the ideology doesn't necessarily value diversity, ethnic diversity or gender, et cetera, as much, explicitly anyway. But on the left side, to have that type of dichotomy and still kind of heralding the inherent democracy of this new platform, then that's a real, real problem. And I don't hear enough people in positions of power on the left talk about that.
Chris Rabb joins us. And Josh Harkinson wants to chime in. But before we get to Josh, Robert Bluey, respond to what Chris was just observing, that there's a sort of hypocritical dimension to that on the left, perhaps less so on the right. I'm curious about, though, participation on the right in terms of gender, age, and race.
Well, I think that most of the studies that you see, I mean, white males are predominantly the ones using the Internet. I mean, I can tell you that all the contributors at Red State, unfortunately, there's only one woman who's an actual contributor who, you know, has front page posting rights, for instance. But, I certainly think that it's just one of those things where even as you just look at the people who are leaving comments or just engaging in general, it just seems that, it is a white male population. I think that's part of the problem, as we talked about earlier, this issue of whether or not the YouTube questions were necessarily representative of the entire population. You have to keep in mind that there were only 3,000 questions submitted. There are 300 million people in America.
Right. So it's 0.001 or whatever.
And also 57%. Only 50%. 57% of online users have used accessed video online and shared it with others. So you're looking at 40-odd percent that either don't have the capacity to do so or don't know about it enough to engage that.
Josh Harkinson, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to put some numbers on some of the things that we've been talking about. You know, in Mother Jones's package, we found in our research that 75% of blog readers are male, and 98% of readers of Daily Kos, the liberal blog, the largest liberal blog, are white, and 87% of YouTube viewers are white. So it really is pretty striking. As far as the gender disparity, I spoke with Maura Ahrens, who is a prominent blogger and who has talked a lot about this issue. And, she's starting a site called Blog Her, which is trying to bring more women into the political sphere. And she's really courting this demographic that she calls the mommy blogger, which is basically mothers who write about not necessarily politics, just their own lives. And they're a huge demographic on the Internet. And she thinks if they can be mobilized, it would make a big difference.
Let's get back to our calls. Again, you can join us at 866-733-6786. Jack is next in Berkeley. Jack, you're on.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that for me, the main use of the Internet is not as a giant calling forum, but it's actually a way to verify or dispute candidates. Say you get thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people bringing their experience, expertise, intelligence to bear on this stuff. It's kind of like Snopes.com refuting urban legends. And to me, that's the main value to the electorate.
Jack, thank you. Thanks for the call. David Weinberger, on that, I mean, one of the ideas that people have often talked about is that there's this army of people who not only can do the sort of fact-checking that Jack was describing, but who you could put to work on a particular issue, that journalists could harness that power somehow to be researchers to work on particular stories, that there's just a lot of person power that can be engaged in the political process or in the journalistic process, for that matter.
There's a lot of interesting projects underway right now. Jay Rosen has one at newassignment.net, which tries to take advantage of distributed journalism for stories where it makes sense, where it would be enormously expensive for a news organization to send out reporters across the world to report on something. There are already people there. They probably already have blogs, and some of them are willing to write it up and do basic research. So there is a type of research problem that is well addressed by this, and it's certainly conceivable that campaigns would figure this out, and for those problems where it makes sense to use the breadth of their supporters as a way of gathering information.
Back to our calls, Gary in Mountain View, or rather Marty in Petaluma. Marty, you're on.
I just wanted to make a comment that the MySpace and the YouTube sites that you're referring to is not something that we as a family participate in because of some of the other content that's available on those websites. I just wanted to find out, it's a very specific, those two sites in general, or specifically are very, the amount of content and other information available, if you get what I'm talking about, is not something appropriate for a family to be involved with.
Yeah, I think we get where you're going with that, Marty. Interesting observation. Josh?
Yeah, you know, I was looking at YouTube last night watching some of the videos from the Democratic debate, and I was looking at some of the other videos posted on the same page as that page. And, you know, there was one question which was just totally obnoxious. It was this guy asking Hillary Clinton whether she thought it was okay to wear white, you know, after Memorial Day, and if so, should you wear a thong or no underwear at all? And, you know, I mean, these worlds of profanity and serious discourse mix in an incredibly powerful way, and it's not always pretty.
How do you respond to that question of there always needs to be an editor, David Weinberger, because as Marty, our caller, and Josh responded, there's a lot out there that is sometimes, you know, might not be suitable, that's difficult to sort through. How can you have, I guess, an environment where no one's in charge and yet you still need someone in charge?
Well, that's what we've been inventing on the web from the very beginning. It's why my book is called Everything is Miscellaneous, by the way. So there's a plug. But
right.
We do need editors, but that doesn't mean that we need an editor class, so to speak. The editors don't have to be CNN and Anderson Cooper. We edit for each other all the time. So it's very easy. In fact, this has already been done for the debate, that you post a page that has links to the 40 questions that were asked, or somebody, a candidate who wants to point to favorable YouTubes, that's what he or she puts on the website. We are constantly remixing and mashing and editing for one another, whether it's through email and mailing lists or whether it's through official sites that are posted by candidates. The openness of the web, long may it wave, and Congress is going to decide that for us pretty soon. FCC will decide that for us pretty soon. The openness of the net ensures that we can edit for one another, which is one of the most powerful functions that we as citizens can play for one another.
A couple of emails coming in also talking back about the YouTube debate. Thank you for the opportunity to express my disappointment with the YouTube debate. I was looking forward to a potential egalitarian type of electoral reform, but it turned out to be the old, same old controlled setup where the frontrunners with the money are given most of the questions pre-selected by the broadcaster and placed in the middle of the stage. Jeff writes, the CNN open forum was not so open, as it turns out. The number one question had to do with the impeachment question. I think this question has been misinterpreted as revenge, but it's more about protecting the Constitution. Again, these are all sort of editorial decisions that are running smack into an environment where control is less easily come by. Rob in Irvine joins us next. Rob, you're on.
Hi. My name is Rob, and I'm from Irvine. I actually was one of the people who got to ask a question, and it was on the debate. I asked Hillary Clinton about how she would define the word liberal.
Ah.
And I asked a bunch of questions on YouTube, and that was probably my least substantial question, and I was actually kind of disappointed that I was genuinely curious about the answer, but I was disappointed that they didn't choose any of the substantial questions.
Well, nonetheless, congratulations, Rob, for getting your questions on the air. What did you think of their answers to that particular question?
You know, Hillary was the only one who actually answered it, and I thought she had a really good answer.
She said she preferred the term progressive, right?
Right, and she gave a legitimate definition of liberal, and I think that it has been turned on its head, as she says. And my only complaint is that she didn't actually say, this is the definition, and yes, I would use that word to describe myself, because if that is the definition, I think she should describe herself with that word.
Rob, good job. Thanks for participating.
Thanks.
Stephen in San Francisco writes, so far the conversation has been on the national level. Can we predict how long the lag time will be until local issues get their due on the internet? Local elections, propositions, local issues. Intriguing question. Do you have any sense of that, David, whether or not this is so far mostly a national phenomenon or whether it is starting to percolate at the ground level as well for local races?
Oh, it's percolating all over the local races. They're not as visible because they're local. But there's a tremendous amount going on using the Internet as a way to connect supporters who, because they're local, actually can get together physically a little more easily to organize events and to establish the type of intimate relationship between the candidate and the representative, ultimately.
Also, here in Philadelphia, we just had a mayoral race, a primary, and blogs were central in terms of influencing the influencer and facilitating grassroots organizing for various of the campaigns that were plugged in.
Chris, what do you mean by influencing the influencer?
Well, I mean, the reality is there are different classes of blogs, and some blogs are written specifically for certain elites, and one of those elites is the media elite, and those folks in the Beltway or Hollywood or Wall Street or Madison Avenue or whatever niche areas. And so there are blogs that people at CNN read religiously or, you know, on Wall Street, et cetera. So in Philadelphia, the veteran journalists and grassroots organizers and activists and campaign workers and, you know, all kinds of folks are reading key blogs here in Philadelphia, and as a matter of fact, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Committee of 70, which is a civic group of lawyers that is like an election watchdog, created the Next Mayor blog, and it had every piece of information you could ever want to know about all five candidates, Democratic candidates, running for mayor, and you could never say, oh, they don't give us enough information. There was information overload. Now, the reality is blogs didn't help generate people coming out to vote, but those people who were committed to voting but hadn't committed to a candidate could now go to a site that was as objective as there could be one site and get meaningful information above and beyond the candidates' respective websites and what they said on TV and radio and print. Hmm. And that was very powerful. And it also was powerful for those folks who were trying to influence the respective candidates' campaigns around certain issue areas like the environment or small business or gay rights, et cetera, and the web was used as a central component in those tactics.
Chris Rabb joining us from Philadelphia this morning. He's the founder of Afro-Netizen. His blog is called bloggingwhileblack.com. Jesse in Menlo Park, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a thought here that the most important part of these debates are the actual answers, which, you know, they're either motherhood and apple pie answers or they're evasive. And I think one of the cool things that we might be considered is take a intercollegiate debate judge or a panel of them and have them score each answer that's given, you know, 1 to 5 or whatever, in terms of having actually answered the question.
Hmm. Jesse, thanks for the observation. Robert Bluey, comment on that and other ways in which this process could be further democratized. You think about something like Amazon or other sites that use consumer ratings. In a sense, Jesse is talking about something like that, where you could sort of rate the answers, I suppose. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea. Absolutely. You know, we saw on CNN how they have this meter that goes up and down when, you know, they have their testers scanning the answers. And, you know, if Obama says something that they like, it spikes. If he says something that they don't like, it goes down. So why not apply that to an online technique? I think that Mike Gravel, who is one of the lesser-known Democrats, but obviously one of the people who's the most entertaining in the debates, had something interesting to say. I saw in a Spin Room interview afterward, let's get rid of CNN entirely, and let's just do this all on YouTube. And I think, you know, based on some of the comments I'm hearing on this show, it might not be a bad idea.
Just time for a last thought or two, so let's go around once on that. David Weinberger, first, if each of you would, either give us a thought on something you think people should really be keeping their eyes out for, or a website that you'd recommend where people can get good political information or get engaged. David first.
Well, I would watch, or the leading indicator I think, are changes in body language and rhetoric, how candidates speak and sound. Already the bombastic sort of stump speech of yesterday is beginning to sound artificial. And that is part of the democratization of the web. And for a website, TechPrez is a great site for keeping up with just this sort of the use of technology by the candidates.
Great. Chris Rabb.
I would recommend colorofchange.org. It's similar to Move On, but it's focused on people of color. And they do some great work around civic engagement specifically, which transcends the ephemera around presidential politics, which is not nearly as important in terms of changing society and culture as civic engagement by a wide swath of people.
So far, we've got colorofchange.org and TechPrez. David, was that TechPrez, T-E-C-H-P-R-E-Z? Or?
It's Tech President, right?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Okay, TechPresident.com? Okay, good. Robert Bluey.
I would say a spinoff of Tech President, which is TechRepublican.com, and it's focused specifically on Republican and conservative issues, and really that's an area that needs a lot of help.
And Robert Bluey, again, his blog is called RobertBluey.com. Josh Harkinson.
Well, of course, the Mother Jones July-August issue. But
somehow I'm not surprised that you would bring that up.
But beyond that, for something really far out, I would look at Twitter, which kind of combines social networking, cell phones, and blogging. Very weird, wild stuff that the techies are going gaga over. Twitter.com, I believe.
Thanks all very much for participating. Josh Harkinson, reporter for Mother Jones magazine. Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Chris Rabb in Philadelphia. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Robert Bluey joined us as well from Washington, D.C. Robert, thanks.
Thank you.
And David Weinberger at the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard University. David, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory with particular assistance these last 2 months from Christina Shaheen. Today is her last day with us. She's done a wonderful job filling in. Christina, thank you. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.